Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday 9 p.m. to midnight on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Later on in the show, I think around 10 o'clock, hopefully Joanne will be joining us, Joanne Summerscales from the Amash Files on PIR, and we're going to be talking about her latest field trip with the biolocation team, which is our experiments and study of forensic dowsing.
You're listening to www.peoplesinternetradio.com, seeking solutions.
Motorhead, on your feet or on your knees, and I've got a new Motorhead album as well, but I haven't had time to load any of that yet. Anyway, here we are back, listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. where I'm joined by Joanne Summerscales. Hi, Joanne. Thanks for joining us.
Giving you all headaches just for a second there. How's the sound? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's looking good to me. That is. Thanks very much. Welcome back. Welcome back to the Dr. Rock Show. It's great to hear your voice again.
Yeah, and hello, everybody at PIR. You know, I've needed a break, and I'm still going to be taking a little bit more of a break, but I've really missed you all. Although I do keep popping in now and again just to have a little peek in the chat room. And I also have to thank Vin and Tony for their support and help, which has continued behind the scenes here and there. So thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's great. Perhaps we'll get a chance a little bit later in the show before we finish to have a quick chat about where you're planning on going next. But I know you're just back from a very exciting, well, sounds like you're very excited about a weekend you just had with the biolocation team. What have you been doing with them this time?
Yeah, I haven't done, and I'm sure I've said this before at the risk of repeating myself, enough work to really nail where they are. But what I have nailed is just so wild in any event. And some of you will have already heard something that I've had to say about them. But I managed to meet up with them a couple of Sundays ago for a field trip. And I'm telling you guys, these are stalwart, stoic people who go out in all weathers, and I mean all weathers. And I was trawling, we were all trawling through the muddy part, and we're almost up to our ankles in it to get to the field where we had, they did a 2-day course actually, and it was looking at telepathy, working with these others that these guys working with. And I'm going to just come back to that in a moment, because I appreciate that I'm delving straight in here and I haven't given some parameters of what I'm talking about. They're linking with what they're calling a confederation, which is a group of 24 different species who have come together basically in a defensive and role, especially against something. Now, I'm going to say this word, but it's very emotive, and some of you may smile about it because we've heard it all too much in Star Wars and all the rest of it, but against a faction and element that they call the Empire. And I'll get to what we're talking about in a second, but these guys, the biolocation team, and it's not just guys, by the way, it's ladies as well, but mainly guys at the moment, have actually in the last months found a way of communicating telepathically with these guys. Now, they've written a couple of books. I'm just going to read a little bit just to paraphrase things, just to give you an idea of their words. And one of their books is called The Phoenix Point, and it's called The Quest for the Science of the Paranormal. And that's by Jeffrey Crockford, one of the leads on it, who's a mere stripling at 81. And Nigel Hughes, who's a Welsh guy who's a KLM pilot for many years, and he's now working in training and God knows whatever else. He's absolutely astonishing, great trainer, great facilitator. So what it says on the back of this book is one aspect of the paranormal has finally yielded to scientific study. A new scientific paradigm clearly demonstrates humans have a sixth magnetic sense. We live out our lives immersed in a sea of magnetic energy that originates from the matter of the Earth and from the stars, planets, and their areas, their moons. The energy contains an enormous amount of information that can be read using a powerful analytical process called biolocation. The sense is particularly attuned to a point in an electromagnetic wave where its energy field dies and regenerates as it travels, linking the sense to this. Phoenix Point resulted in many major discoveries. People of pre-Roman Britain built so-called stone monuments that were in fact impressive magnetic energy machines. Stonehenge and the Cove at Avebury still work today. This knowledge was lost as a result of a Roman genocide. Subsequent ignorance of the role the sense plays in human biology vanished to a world of the paranormal. Why the essence of this sixth sense has evaded science for so long must be a wake-up call for the effectiveness of modern scientific thinking. Reports of electronic equipment causing ill health are increasing, and conventional scientific paradigms have been unable to link the two. The scientific paradigm underlying the human magnetic sense clearly shows that advances in information and communication technology are flooding our environment with complex magnetic fields that may be toxic to our nervous system. The paradigm questions whether research into electronic health concerns is looking at the wrong causes of a potentially very serious large-scale illness. Now, that's from their first book. Now, what they discovered initially was that these guys who are, I don't know, more than 20 years in their dowsing skills came together as a team. That they're sort of in the Hemel Hempstead. I can't think of, is it Bedfordshire there? Hearts, Bedfordshire. I'm not quite sure of the county there. And just through various means met up and began working together as, you know, these coincidences happen, and began to find anomalies. Now, these anomalies were readings that they couldn't put any of their usual tests to discern what they were getting. Now, there's a guy called Peter Vincent, sometimes known as Peter Ellis, and he has a wider spectrum of awareness in terms of he's much more, if you like, psychically attuned to a wider spectrum of information. I know it sounds very vague, but let's just call it like that. And what he realized was that they were picking up extraterrestrial through various testing. And, you know, this wasn't just found to be over one day. This was many months, and then it's now been years of testing. So this took a whole lot of people who had no interest in the ET UFO scenario or even had an inkling of any cosmic, you know, stuff going on in our heavens that we are blinded to at the moment because of fields and other shielding that's going on. And so it was with some trepidation that these guys began on this trip. And they now have amongst their team a physicist. And Don, the physicist, is now setting up, as I heard on that Sunday, a new company. And it's a name of something like space travel technology, something like that, mm-hmm. similar. And he's setting this company up to eventually produce the equipment that these guys are discerning and drawing out technically from their dowsing. Now, this is phenomenal. They have been told, this group of people, and kind of I'm on the sidelines of this, although I'm intending to get much more involved as I can in the near future. These guys have been told by this faction of humans, they may be human hybrids, I'm not quite sure. They say they're humans, they're quite a bit taller than we are, and these guys have been interacting now with the biolocation team very deeply. And these these folks, and that began earlier last year. I can't tell you when, but I think in the first quarter of last year, they began to have telepathic contact. Now, the way that these guys began to make their presence felt to the bio team in terms of communication, and I mean one-on-one communication, was that they began blocking their dowsing. Now, these guys know very well, they've done a tremendous amount of work on the interference of and blocking of different substances, chemicals, etc., and fields that may block their dowsing of anything. So
it was how their interest in it was originally sparked, wasn't it? It was a piece of wood fell in front of a magnet when somebody was dowsing.
Yeah.
And it killed it stopped the dowsing rods from working.
And so does garlic. And so do prawns.
Really?
and so do onions.
Right. Yeah, well,
for at least an hour if you've ingested them.
I have heard that onions and garlic are not as good for us as people would have us believe.
You know, I've heard that too, but I haven't done enough research to come back and comment on that. But anyway, in the dowsing world, they cause a deflection, a blocking, if you like, of the signal. However, what these guys were finding in this instance, there was no garlic present. There was none of the normal blocking things going on. So what they were finding was that this was done intelligently. And so their curiosity peaked. They began checking what was blocking them, and they found it was a person. And they and this person allowed them to douse them, and they were able to. That began the ball rolling of communication. And Jeff Crockford particularly has found a way. He has fine tuned his inner workings, if you like, to be able to communicate now very easily with a being that goes by the name of Ailing. And I communicated with Ailing myself, which was an interesting experience, just briefly. And I was asking them just some very basic questions about, or her, this is a female, about what they were doing. Now, just to leap forward into just leaving Ailing there for a moment, I'll come back to the questions I asked her. But what I'd seen them working with on the Sunday. On the Saturday, they had been doing specific types of work, which I wasn't able to join them for. So on the Sunday, the field, what these guys do, they will maybe, in this case, it was a place called, I think it was Little Hay, place very near Chesham and, Beaconsfield, I think it is, called Boxmoor, where they've got a barn. There's also another conference center nearby linked with it, but you can hire out this barn and it's a field. It's often a dog walking place, but people don't tend to come across the field because it gets very muddy. They tend to walk around it. Anyway, it's a very nice environment, but quite exposed. So you get a lot of land to work with. So what the biolocation team are able to do and have perfected to a high degree of sensitivity, and they work in concert with one another, and they test, double test and blind test one another as much as possible with what they pick up, especially if it's something, you know, kind of mind bending or challenging, which just about everything is that they're doing at the moment, because they are very interested themselves in promoting the science aspect of what they're doing, and that is their orientation, because these guys are science orientated. So
this is interesting, isn't it? Can you give us any background, because the challenging of the effectiveness of the modern scientific paradigm is quite evident, in as far as the modern scientific paradigm has failed to explain all sorts of things that they choose to call paranormal.
Yes.
And the scientific method that's working, of course, would have to recognize these things as normal because they're really common. Have they managed to validate any of this stuff that they have? What's their method of doing that, just to give us some idea of the base they're coming from?
Yes, what they've been doing, because, see, the thing is, again, it's about looking with new eyes. And, I mean, this isn't very new. It's a magnetic field. But what they have found, I mean, and don't forget, guys, they didn't start looking for this. This came and found them and bit them in the bum pretty hard and got their attention. They didn't really want to go down this road. This was far too ooh-ow for them. And now it's their norm. I mean, pretty much their norm anyway. So they've had quite a personal journey to get to this point where they can speak as I'm going to speak about their work. And that's been quite a challenge. And it's certainly a challenge for their families and their friends, let me tell you. This is a hard won task for them to maintain doing what they're doing, because some of it's very common in this whole field and my area of research that, you know, people can lose friends and family friendships and all the rest of that.
Plus the fact that clearly they're dealing with a field which certain parts of our team don't really want to be revealed.
Exactly. Yeah. You've just made an excellent, excellent point. So let me just go back to what they test. So how they test, rather. So Nigel, one of the main ones. Now there's about four or five main players at the moment and then there are sort of between 6, 8, maybe 10 others who are feeding into the research. So that core group are interacting with on a daily basis and sometimes several times a day with these ailing and her companions, let's say these other humans. And what they do, so if they find something, so if something is brought to their attention, say Nigel's has some information that one of his guide gives him and he douses it and he finds what he finds, he will then call the others and he won't tell them. He won't give them the details. He will get them to feed back to him what it is. And that's really, you know, gosh, I've had quite a few goes now at this work. And it is, they can get really, really precise data information. And they are logging this. You know, there's another book in the offing. There are papers and scientific papers being written as we speak. And I think Don, who's a physicist, he really regrets selling the company when he retired that he had. He said, I could have been manufacturing what we're finding here. So they are quite seriously moving toward manufacture.
I'd say that if they're successfully managing to replicate results with each other.
Yeah, they are.
Because the thing is, the dowsing, I know that that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. There's psychological factors involved, and I know.
Absolutely, they're very aware of that.
They're also dealing with the commingling, effectively, of two different magnetic fields, aren't they? So for them to have the sensitivity and the exactness to be replicating each other's results using dowsing is itself demonstrating something which the scientific paradigm has failed to validate.
Absolutely. And I know what this sounds like as I'm speaking to you. I know that. And, you know, in some ways I can just feel this wall of energy which you know, which will deflect any reality of this. But anyway, I absolutely now personally am at a point, and it wasn't that I wasn't here before, but if I had any inkling, any kind of little smidgen of a doubt, that is wholly gone. And what I saw on Sunday, Nigel kind of walked me around what we'd got. So what we'd got on the ground was our solar system partially brought down, and they can scale things up or down. So they use a field to scale, and they can scale to light years. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. So what we were looking at was we'd got the sun, we'd got the moon, we'd got Earth, and that's what we were looking at essentially. So they hadn't brought all the rest of the planets down yet of the solar system, but they've done it so many times they can do this with their eyes closed now, so they know exactly where everything is and they know what they're working with. So then what they showed me, which was jaw-dropping, I mean, it takes a lot for my jaw to drop these days, I tell you.
I'll bloody bet it does.
But they showed me, so first of all, they showed me the Earth, and as I was looking at the Earth, Nigel was describing that I was looking at it pole to pole, So I wasn't looking at it on its axis. I was looking at it lying down. So the particularly where I was looking at it would have been the Pacific and the Australian side. And around that side, way up in space, were this flotilla. I don't know if flotilla is the right, correct word. Fleet. Now it was, you know what? I should have taken some more notes, but it was something like 10 wide, 4 deep and whatever. It was a massive schedule fleet of craft, and they were circumnavigating the Earth. They were coming in I'm not sure actually where they're coming from, but anyway, they're coming out. They were coming, skimming, way beyond Earth and coming around the other side of the sun. And the other side of the sun was a body. And this body cannot be seen from Earth. So we're not aware of it at the moment. And I don't know if we will. I'm sure we must have to be aware of it at some time because of magnetic fields. But anyway, I'll come to that later. And what they were showing me, and what these craft and fleets were doing, was they were servicing the building of this planet that was behind the sun. These humans are coming to live in our solar system. They've been in and out of it so much. And I kind of said to Jeff, I said, that's interesting. I wonder why they're choosing our solar system. He said, that's an interesting choice of words. It's not our solar system. He said, it is a solar system in which we live, but it's not ours. No. These guys have been around for hundreds of thousands.
We're definitely relative newcomers, aren't we?
We are. And these guys also, these humans left Earth, actually, they were here on this planet some 14,000 years ago. And I think that was related to the floods. Now, I'm sure someone will pick me up if I'm wrong about the timing of the flood. I know there have been several floods on the planet, but anyway. No,
about 10,000 BC, so about 12,000 years or so ago or so.
So we're kind of in the right ballpark figure of a time. So it could be 12, could be 14. I understood 14. So anyway, we'll say 14 because I guess they would have left well before that happened. So these guys have been part of this federation. Now, I don't know the infill story there. I don't know. They are talking to me about me joining this team more fully so that I also begin to work with they're calling them guides, a guide from this unit of humanity. And I think they are hybrids. Although I got a reading, when I was talking to Eiling, conversing with her, Jeff was holding the communication open, and then he said, okay, she's in front of you, and you can douse her. So all I did, I kept the name of her name in my mind, and I moved forward to empty space as far as we could see with our physical eyes, and the rods crossed very strongly. And then I just asked her about and she mentioned I asked a question in relation to the sun, and I got a very strong positive, and I hadn't clicked then. I hadn't realized that they were actually going to be inhabiting that planet, which was way the other side of our sun. And these guys are amazingly, they're building a planet, really?
I think people have been building moons for quite some time, so I guess the planet's probably not a problem.
I think so too, but you know, when it's in your own backyard and you're meeting current day humans who are talking to you about this, it kind of brings another degree of reality, another strand. You know, it's like these guys working with this telepathy business. It's like building new neurons and synapses and stuff like that, you know, getting the brain.
I think that's exactly what you're doing.
It is. Yeah. It is. And so maybe that the planetary bodies as macro versions of our synapses and stuff are also kind of coming together and beginning to fire together. So there is a more unity consciousness. Now, what is, you know, I've heard quite a lot of traumatic stories as well as positive ones about interaction of humanity and ET and all the rest of that. And so I was a little bit concerned about why these amazingly advanced technological peoples are bothering with the biolocation team. I mean, I love them to bits, but, you know.
Perhaps because they're the first ones who've actually got any kind of means of actually definitely knowing what's happening to them and evidencing it, as it were.
Well, you've actually hit the nail absolutely on the head. They are calling themselves, this planetary body, as far as I'm aware, is going to be called Helios. And so I'm just calling them the Helians, and, you know, that name may well change. But anyway, let me just reference them that, then keep saying these other humans. So the Helians have told the bio team that never before ever has humanity done this and accessed these fields or read them or done anything with them the way the bio team are doing. This is apparently a first. This is breaking away from, you know, something and moving into a brand new way of perceiving and functioning. And it is this magnetic field. Now, it is awesome and mind-boggling in the true sense of the minute detail that these guys are going. I mean, this is heavily labor-intensive. This is not a romantic, you know, easy thing. These guys have taken to task this whole subject, and really, initially, it was to prove to themselves whether this could be true or not. I mean, this was
isn't that how we all start? Okay, no, yeah. That can't be bloody right.
That's right. I mean, these are sensible, logical, scientifically orientated people who are absolutely steeped in. I mean, you know, a year or so back, they would never be having this kind of conversation with me that I'm having with you, they've had with me. And they're fairly blown away themselves, let me tell you. They have, you know, kind of rebalanced and got a grip again, but
They've got 13 years of developing this system as well, haven't they? And yet it's only in the last year or so that it's really taken off, or that's when the telepathy came in.
The telepathy's been going probably for less than a year, but they've been going looking at the ET stuff since about the time that Amash began, give or take 6 months, which is just interesting. And it was within about 18 months that Peter contacted me. I didn't know who the biolocation team were, had never heard of them, but he became aware of my work and he said, you need to pay attention to this. This is going to open some doors. This is going to bring some awareness and information in like never before. And, I mean, my God, that was 3 or so years ago. And it has developed so incredibly to what they're doing. And luckily, one or two of them can draw. There's been some fantastic drawings of what they've been seeing. And also, these guys can specify the sort of being that is on board craft. Now, they've been mentioning the aquatics. Now, they've only called them the aquatics because there are other aquatics. There are many, many different species of aquatics, marine kind of beings who, have the intelligence and are piloting crafts and part of civilizations that they have seen. However, there is a faction of them, a very, very powerful faction of them, that are known, that they call the deep sea aquatics. These are unbelievably intelligent, unbelievably clever and canny and cunning. And these also come in on a very dogmatic, fascistic kind of vibration. And these guys apparently have been held back by the Federation for I don't know how long. I couldn't tell you if it's been eons or whatever. Anyway, but certain in recent history, and when I say recent history, I'm talking about in the last 6 months. So I'm going to talk about September. In September, I went and joined one or two of the team for a celebration of one of their 50th wedding anniversaries, which was a lovely thing to attend. Needless to say, no sooner were the celebrations over than the bio team, we all were huddling around in the front room with our dowsing rods. And Peter had brought back what he believes are fossilized spinal bits of spine, human spine, and feet and hands from somewhere. I won't mention in case, because he says I really shouldn't be taking these. But anyway, nobody thinks these are anything other but some rocks that have gone into funny shapes. But they aren't. They douse as having belonged to somebody, not a rock. So this was absolutely phenomenal. Anyway.
Do they have some means of assessing what it is they're looking at?
Yeah, they do. I'll come back. Can I come back to that in just one second?
Sorry.
Just because there's so many different strands of the work here I think it's very exciting, and I'm going to throw out an opportunity for anybody who wants to be involved to come forward and experience this for yourself, because we need some new team members and we need some folks to join us, because the Helians are looking for about 100 people that they can help train as telepaths to communicate with them, not with ourselves, not between you and I, but between them, because there are things that are going to come to pass, as the book says, and it's not going to be in the very distant future. And they need some people on board who are going to be able to communicate. Let's put it like that. I'll talk about that a bit more in a moment or two. However, just back to this celebration, this lovely time and getting all this stuff out. And then Nigel takes me to one side and says, oh, my God, Joanne, we really thought we'd bought it. I went, what are you talking about? And these guys are not prone to drama. They are not. They aren't. They're just lovely human beings, very down to earth. He said, we were told by our lot, the Helians, they didn't know they were Helians at the time, that the aquatics had broke through from the Barnard Star. I couldn't tell you how many light years the Barnard Star is away. But anyway, that seems to factor in to some other people's information that they've been given. I've mentioned this Barnard Star business to one or two other experiences, and they both went, oh, my God, Barnard Star, that's really important. And it really got their attention, what I was telling them, which is what I'm about to tell you, which was that these aquatics, who are incredibly powerful as well, not only mentally and physically, but they are awesomely creative in their technology, so they're very aggressive, and they are you wouldn't want to be living under their rule. You know, someone said to me, one of the team said, we've been told by these others that if they'd broken through, think Nazi and then double it or treble it, and that's what it would have been like. Anyway, these aquatics had broken through from the Barnard Star, so The Federation, I know this sounds like, I know exactly what this sounds like. I know it sounds like a story from Star Wars, but I'm just going to say it as I've been told it. And they said, and they broke through. It was a bit like the Federation were caught with the pants down or caught napping or something, but they just didn't have enough vehicles to repel them. And so they broke through and they were heading to our solar system. And the Earth is at the moment, you know, a jewel in the solar system. And they wanted it, and they wanted possession of it, and that's where. And they didn't quite make it. They made it to the edge of our solar system. They made it. They were nearly through. Now these Helians had said to the guys, "Listen, guys, this is deadly serious. We can't tell you how serious this is. We have been really dealt a blow. We don't know how we're going to recover. We are waiting for more resources." Well, you know, like the cavalry. We're waiting for more teams to come in to add to, you know, the Federation's defences. It's not here at the moment. We are hanging on by our fingernails. We will, if you want, we will come and pick you up. We'll take you if you want to come. Let us know. And so the guys said, yeah, we're going to come. I mean, one of them had asked their wife if she would possibly, can you imagine saying to your wife, you're a significant other who isn't into this at all. Darling, how would you feel about leaving this solar system on a, you know, on a spacecraft and, you know, and she said, well, what about the animals? He said, well, we can't take them. She said, well, I'm not going. And that's that. Anyway, so it got to a point where they had some more communication and it was very scant, but they said it's we're too stretched, we can't come for you. We're sorry. We can't do it.
Well, that must have been a hell of a disappointment.
Well, you know, the Helians were desperate at this point because they honestly didn't know how this their backs were against the wall and they didn't know if they were going to succeed. They just didn't know at this point. And well, the bio team just thought, well, that's how it goes. You know, that's life, as you know, what can you do? But the bio team absolutely believed what these guys said, and they believed that an imminent invasion was on the cards. At the last minute, there were more factions coming in on the defences, and they were routed and repelled. This is the story.
It's great to think that there are actually other entities out there who are kind of helping out, because you sometimes look at mankind and you think, well, you lot just don't stand the snowball's chance on you, Todd.
Well, we don't, actually. We truly, honestly don't. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, love and light to all, but I don't think that, you know, being ruled by marauding lot of... people with, or beings with, kind of that Nazi mentality, and you'll know what I mean by that without me having to explain it, you know, that wouldn't be good. That's not great. So anyway, they were repelled and they have been routed. And I said, as of the last sort of communication, where are we with the aquatics? How far? He said, oh no, they have been pushed way back. They are way back. I went, sure. They said, yeah. They managed it anyway. So I don't know whether I haven't had enough time to sit down and chat with the guys to find out whether the Helians are coming into our solar system as a defensive measure or whether they are going to come down and pay us a visit and share apple pie. No idea.
You say they're humans. Do they come from Earth, therefore? Because I've heard a lot of guests on your show talking about ETs as humans, almost like we are already in loads of different places.
Are we? Well, I can tell you as well, just as an aside, that, and I've mentioned this before, I'm sure, that Sixto Paz Wells, who's the Peruvian contactee, talked about the fact that he went to, I can't remember if it was Ganymedes or Apple, one of the moons of Jupiter, and he was absolutely shocked and stunned to see, he was told 12,000 humans were there. These are humans, and these are people who had fallen through some kind of time dimensional thingy where if they were brought back, their nervous systems, their bodies would not tolerate the change in environment, in frequency, and they would die.
Yeah, I remember that interview.
Yeah, so these guys, you know, so there are humans out there. Now, those humans didn't choose to go there, and they weren't kidnapped either or space-napped. It was some kind of accident of life.
They fell off the log.
They fell off the log, but were kept rescued. It reminds me of Hitchhiker's Guide, you know.
Yeah. I hope they had their towels with them.
Yes. But so there are clearly other humans out there, and perhaps many more than we know. But my feeling, these people were on Earth this 14,000 years ago. I'm going to say 14,000 because that's what the bio team have said and that they've been told by the Helians. So they were, you know, residents of this Earth at that time. But this new Earth being built, you know, is going to be their new home. And when I asked A-Ling if they were planning to show themselves to us in a way that, you know, was absolute, she said yes. And I went, oh, okay, do we have a time frame on that? And June was a time frame on that, very strong time frame, June, July, and August. But also, I've heard since in the last sort of 2 or 3 days that one of the reasons that they were going to show themselves so soon was because of the dangers from these other entities or elements of, the cosmos. And they were wanting to alert humanity to these dangers. So it's important that we have some kind of education about what's going on And at the moment, we are totally blind to it. But
and I guess that what they're dealing with is the only team so far that is actually equipped with the ability to get such a message across without having it ignored or derided, as has happened to so many of your interlocutors in the past.
Yes, that's correct. So I don't know. And now the heat is off, if you like, of our planet being endangered in at least from any marauding aquatics or whatever. And when you hear, I'm just emphasizing the aquatics, can I said to Jeff, well, you know, can you tell me about the composition? What makes you call them aquatics? He said, oh, yes. He said, we've now got a list of different types of species, anaerobic, exaerobic, copper-based blood, iron-based blood. And so these guys now are able to get down pat the composition of these beings and also have a very good idea of what they look like. I'm not sure what the aquatics look like. But
so their book must be bloody amazing. What's it called?
I don't know what the latest book that they're working on. They have got the Phoenix Point, which is their first one. Yeah. And then they have, I think it's called The Secret of the Stones. I'll quickly Google that and just find out what that is. But that is quite a tome. It's about 40 or 50 quid to buy because it's a massive book. I think it's like a print on demand, but it is stuffed full with all their research and work over a period of time. So you get, so with the two books, they are not keeping any of this to themselves. Peter has sent a lot of the information to the astronomer, Lord Rees, Astronomer Royal. They've sent it to the armies, the military, the police, governments. Peter sent this information absolutely everywhere. So these guys who are high up cannot say they did not know if anything comes to pass where there is interaction of one kind or another. But
they must be making some waves.
Do you know what? They're a very quiet, small group. And I don't know. You know, maybe when Don gets a company off the ground and they actually start producing some vehicles, maybe then, because the Helians are showing them their technology. The Helians are teaching them about their lives. They're showing them basic things like their quarters, what their place looks like, all of that kind of stuff. And I can't tell you all that detail at the moment because I don't know it all. But so what I mean is that they're having very deep relations, intimate relations with these beings. There's a great degree of trust that has been developed on each party. And when they are, when these guys are called out in the early hours of the morning to work with them, because these Helians know of no real time, they sometimes want to work with the guys and get them to solve some of the problems. Because just going back to the question that I asked Nigel on this occasion about, what is it, these super intelligent, super technologically advanced beings, what can they possibly want? And they said, they don't know how we are accessing and doing what we're doing. Because Nigel, Jeffrey, Don, and the others were able to show the Helians as they scaled down a picture of the solar system, and then to some extent, I don't know how far out into the galaxy, they could see craft coming in and out, and they were showing the Helians what they were seeing. So now the Helians are able to duplicate some of their work, and they're able also to read.
So now they're doing things not only that our modern scientific method has been unable to do, but they're doing things that their ET counterparts can't do either.
Yeah, they are learning to. So this is a symbiotic relationship. It's really rather beautiful, to be honest, because we as humans, well, I'll speak for myself. I as a human being, if I'm a human being fully, do not credit myself with much power, energy, or ability, particularly. I'm being told that this is not the case, that we are seen as something pretty amazing, despite our, you know, belligerence and our curmudgeonly behaviors and God knows whatever else our, you know, our psychopathic orientation. But I don't think that's all our fault. I do think there's, you know, we are being manipulated greatly, but I won't go down that track.
It also sounds like there might be races out there that are even further down the list than we are, which also is comforting.
Yeah. Also,
it's a bit alarming as well, I guess.
Yeah. How wonderful to think that, we can affect change and positive interactions and relations with another race who has developed, you know, not hundreds, probably thousands of years in advance of us. And I have to tell you, this is really exciting. This was Don showed me some photographs, and what I was looking at was a small swirl on grass, and it was about 18 inches across. But they do have some which are maybe 3 to 4 feet across. And I said, "What am I looking at?" Of course, it's a swirl in the grass, but it was very discreet. It was very specific, and he said that is from their personal power packs. Or units. I went, really? That is wild. Because, you know, we're dealing with the magnetic field, which our senses don't see physically. So it's very hard for us humans to work with that. We can't see it, smell it, touch it. But we can read it with our own bodies. But this is the thing. We are interacting with nothing more than our own magnetic fields.
Which is, of course, what dowsing always has been, although we've not been able to explain
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We've been close to it, but not got it actually quite right.
Yeah. Yeah. So how what these Helians are doing when they come and interact with the guys, they can't come without any support mechanism. So they come in these like personal transport vehicles or whatever you want to call them. Anyway, that's what they are. And their exhaust, the exhaust from this, which they can douse the chemical, and they can chemically analyze the exhaust, which they have done. And don't ask me what that is, because I didn't ask them what that was. But it was just enough to see these photographs of the swirls in the grass that have been photographed many times. And this, and so from nothing, and then off they've gone, and there's the swirl. And you think, well, wow, we can actually see something. That's amazing. That is phenomenal. That's very exciting, because then you can read it. And the guys are reading things using chemical witnesses. These witnesses, what I mean by witnesses is that they will have, for example, if they want to check if an area has blood and bone in it, as if, you know, like an ancient site or anything, they will use a bit of phosphate, maybe chicken bone, or maybe a drop of blood that's just put out on a piece of paper or card. And every time they go to check that, they'll have the witness in their hand and they'll check it now.
So that's how they're attuning themselves to these particular frequencies, because, again, that's how people apparently traditionally find water and minerals and all the rest of it.
Yes.
They've actually got things they've made up in advance that allow them.
Yes. The dowsers and the dowsing society uses a color wheel as well. And this is really a wheel, a circle split into partitions of color. And different colors have different meanings. And, for example, when they pick up green, green is generally seen as a communication channel. And they've often seen green as a standing wave as well. And they can measure it. They can measure the depth of it. And this is amazing, because on the weekend, I took Peter along. I went to pick him up and took him along. And he picked up something that the other members of the bio team hadn't done. Now, what we were looking at, just as an aside, another thing that they had, if you like, brought down into holographic, into the environment as a hologram. And I'll explain that as best I can in a minute. What they'd got, they peg out, like you might use tent pegs, and then they will have tape, like a bit like a crime scene thing. You know, they're taping it off, but they're taping off the shapes, say, of the planet or whatever, or they're taping off, you know, in this case, they had canes which were around this, these other spokes, if you like, that they put in the ground to delineate the environment that we were looking at. And so they were reading, I'm not so skilled yet, but they were reading all kinds of different things from it, like propulsion system. And what they got, what we were looking at, was a captured craft. And it was a captured craft from one of the aquatics. Now, I don't know what happened to the aquatics. You know, there was so much going on, I didn't even get to ask that question. But it, so whether they were dead or it was just abandoned, who knows?
Can I ask a question from the chat box?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Jason's asking, he's saying, how can we be sure that they are of superior intelligence?
He says,
if I turned up on a different planet with an iPhone and seem like I'm of superior intelligence, yet I have no idea how the technology works, but I simply possess it.
Yeah, I understand, Jason, and that's a very good point. All I can say is they're not saying they're super intelligent. They're not. We're saying it because what they're showing us and what they're doing and their ability to travel faster than light speed, well, we can't do that yet, so they have to have a little bit of a head start on us.
We apparently can't do it yet.
Well, we apparently can't do it yet. Yeah. Okay, so it's not that they're saying, hey, you know, you little humans, we're better than you. That's not the relationship at all. This is not that. They're working with the bio team on an equal footing, and the bio team have absolutely dedicated themselves to this work, to uncover, discover, reveal not only what it is about the hidden human history that has been so well hidden from us, but also about our current and to be future relationships will be within the cosmos. And personally, from the research that I've done with all the people I've spoken to over the 5 years I've been doing EMASH and prior to that, I absolutely believe that we are heading in that direction. That is to having, I know a cosmic relationship sounds like, you know, ridiculous, perhaps, but I don't know whatever, what other language to use. Mm. So I will say relationship with others who are not of Earth. Let me put it like that. Now, what the bio team said to me as well, just they made me laugh. They said, you know, when the rest of the Earth wakes up to the fact that, now what did they say? Was it 9 or 6 different species are already in our solar system living in, you know, Mars, wherever? He said they're going to be awfully surprised.
Yeah.
These guys have got such a laissez-faire attitude to this. I mean, they're really hard working people. And I said, it's not easy to go out in storms and weathers of all kinds. And in all weathers, they can't always douse, but...
Yes, it can be difficult in high winds.
Yeah, it's amazing.
There's obviously, as I'm sure comes as no surprise, there's one or two people in the chat box who think you sound fairly crazy. A man we used to know as Sol, who we now know as Earth is Flat, because he believes the Earth is flat, says you sound like you're away in fairyland. How would you answer a man who believes the Earth is flat that tells you that you're making it up?
You know, all I can say is each to their own. I honestly don't feel I have to validate my own my own feelings and thoughts. And, you know, you have to walk in the shoes quite a way. You have to get yourself very immersed in the subject field and the environment and the people to be able to have that opinion. And I don't think you have. If you have, you know, been a few years around the subject matter and doing, you know, the in-depth studies, then fair enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's very easy to be skeptical. I'm skeptical. And I, you know, every time I go to the bio team or even an experiencer or whoever I'm talking to or another researcher and they come to me with new material or something I haven't come across before, I'll go, really? You know, what makes you think that? And it's just simply, it hasn't visited my experience yet. And I know very little. Mm-hmm. I feel like humanity is looking out of an arrow slit of a window when there is a 360-degree focus out there. We are, you know, just such youngsters on the block. Yeah. And because of the nature of the structure of our bodies, our nervous systems, we can only take in so much at a time, because that's just how we how we are, how we're built.
And as I was saying earlier, we have to choose what it is that we're going to learn, because we can't learn everything. I mean, personally speaking to you and having listened to every single Amash show, I must admit, I would feel a good place to go to from here would be to the book and you know, see in a bit more detail what you've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, each to their own. You know, I've just seen that old Tiger Boy says she sounds like L. Ron Hubbard. I don't if you know L. Ron Hubbard, you won't think I'll be sounding like him at all.
No, yeah.
Very interesting.
Let's deal with one more query from the chat box and then have a bit of music, shall we? And then come back.
Sure, absolutely.
Is that cool? Because Rich asked, he said, what do you know about Pleiadians? You must have heard a bit about them in your time.
and people tell me that they have had experiences with them. And, you know, you've got people like Adamski from, you know, another decade or so back talking about links with those guys. And they seem to be interacting and have interacted with many people on the planet. I haven't interacted with any of these guys, by the way. So no. I don't have any personal information. But, you know, there isn't just one person or two or three in one area that's spoken about these kind of folks or the Greys or any of these other people, reptilians or whoever else you want to talk about. There's many, and it's worldwide. You know, I had some communication from someone in the Ukraine recently. This is, you know, this is not just local guys.
No, indeed. And like I say, really, I've been interested in this subject for a long time. I do have in certain areas of it a kind of personal interest, although like you, I've never encountered them. I do know people who have. But it's only, but I mean, you know, you've talked to the Prime Minister of New Zealand and the guy who was the ex-defence minister and spoken with people in some detail about what the presidents know or don't know about what's going on. We've heard Bill Cooper talking about it in very, very studied and interesting depth. And I don't think Bill Cooper is an unreliable witness myself. It is, as you know, it's one of my main fields of interest, is the schism between the people who know it's going on and the people who definitely know that it isn't.
Yes, well, maybe when we come back, we can talk about a little bit about William Mills Tompkins, who's a gentleman who's written a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials, My Life in the Top Secret World of UFOs, Think Tanks and Nordic Secretaries.
Excellent. Yes, well, that sounds like a great place to start. When we come back, we will do that. So we'll have 4 or 5 minutes, Joanne. I'll stick on Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra and Killed by Love. And we'll be back with you soon. Thanks for being
here. And that sounds like I've got time to make a cup of tea. Yay.
I think you have. I'll keep an eye out for you and we'll be back shortly, folks.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Dr. Rock's radio show, Seeking Solutions, on peoplesinternetradio.com.
There we go. That was ZZ Top, of course, and Arrested for Driving While Blind. Who'd be unkind enough to do that? You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show, where I'm in conversation with Joanne this evening. Just before we kick back off again, though, I'd like to remind people that Freeman Jack is on after Dr. Rock's radio show at midnight. So once again, me and Jack and Nick have re-established our kind of monopoly on Thursdays, which we lost a couple of years back now. So we're once more winning. Anyway, Joanne, thanks very much for coming back. I know you're back there. Anyway, I know we're going to have a quick chat about Mike and then move on to another subject of interest. So where do you want to start?
That I've been writing his story with him. So it's essentially a biography and, well, I'm co-authoring it with him. But we've now done it. We've now done the work and we are going to spend, I think, probably the next week or so just fine-tuning the grammar or whatever. But the story is told, and that is amazing. And I the reason I wanted to flag up Mike again, as I've done in the past, as I said, is because he was one of those people who thought people like me were a nut job completely. Now, what's amazing about his story is that this is a guy who's an experiencer. He's an ex-soldier. He's also a musician. And a bit of a raconteur. He's a Jack the Lad, really always was. Anyway, he contacted me over 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago or so now, because he had nearly died during 1 week where he had several strokes, several heart attacks, all at one time. Such were the stressors that he was going through. And I am sure those were partly because of the underlying ET experiences which had been happening to him all his life.
And the thing about his experiences is that they actually affected other people, didn't they? Like the guys he was working for and his wife and just so many other people witnessed the weirdness but not the explanation.
The knock-on effect was astonishing, and the reason they didn't have an explanation was because he didn't know. He didn't know anything about his experiences until he was 44. Now, imagine living two-thirds or more of your life unconscious of huge experiences that totally blow the paradigm open of extraterrestrial contact or, you know, other intelligent connection or whatever you want to name or term that other interaction.
And the thing is with him is it didn't. These realizations didn't make him look crazy. They actually came up, they actually provided explanations for things that had happened to him previously, which did make him look crazy. That's the thing that's really struck me about his story.
Yes. Bless him, the poor sod. I mean, he was taken on several occasions during his work time. Particularly, I'm thinking when he was driving. Mm. And because things happened and time was missing and whatever, he lost jobs. But yeah. He didn't know what was happening. And the other people didn't know what was happening either. Each party thought the other was being obtuse, awkward, difficult, bombastic, you know.
Nobody had the facts.
Nobody had the facts. Nick, that is absolutely the truth. And we still don't have all the facts of Mike's experiences, but we have now a lot, because at 44 years old, he had what I call a download, what he calls a download. But for anybody who doesn't know what that could mean, if you think of what is now put forward as a near-death experience, where your entire life is run before you like some super, you know, speedy film, and you see and know and feel everything of it in an instant. That's what happened to him when he was coming back from a gig, having travelled over the Berwyn Mountains, having seen a UFO, having lost 26 miles of time. And I know that, you know, we know the timings, we know things, because I went and did a field trip with Mike in 2014 and walked and went to all the major areas that he had these experiences, apart from Germany, where he was a soldier. Mm. And part of Mike's experiences, I mean, they began when he was three, we believe, when he was three. And certainly at 10 years old, he met some tall Nordic-looking blondes, whether they were Pleiadians or whatever, we don't know. We've come to call them the Nordics because it's become kind of common terminology for them, but we don't really know what they are.
It's because what they look like, isn't it? They're sort of
it's because of what they look like, and there may be several different species of them or races of them, you know, we don't know yet. Anyway, but when he had at 10 years old a one-on-one contact with these guys whose spaceship had landed in a field that he was just having a chill out session in as a 10-year-old, and asked him if he'd help the planet because it was in, you know, Earth was in trouble, would he help if he could? And he said yes, and they did tell him that he would be hated. They did say, if you do that, but of course, as a 10-year-old, you don't have any sense of what that could possibly mean. And he, you know, forgot that experience until after he was 44 years old, I beg your pardon. And so, I mean, when he was first in the army as an 18-year-old in Germany, he was at a base that was shared with Americans. And not any Americans. These were Americans from Area 51. Well, in 1968, nobody knew who the frig or what the frig Area 51 was. Mm. But he was told it was Area 51 by a colleague who did know in 1968. So, you know, Area 51 meant nothing to Mike. He thought, oh, just another lot of Americans. The reason that they were there was because it was a nuclear base, one of only two in the world at that time. And he was there in Sennelager in Germany. And interestingly enough, Mike was called by a guy who who'd been in Senalaga himself and was just finishing his term as a soldier there, and contacted me and then Mike, and spent some time talking to Mike because he was so freaked out because he'd seen a reptilian. And what was very interesting is that I did some research about the research group who were doing some work around the bases and around the areas. It was a bit like a group that goes chasing poltergeists and hauntings. And what was astonishing to me is that quite a lot of military personnel had reported seeing reptilians around the base and around the area. I mean, for goodness sake. Mm. I mean, it's awesome. Anyway, so what was also interesting about Mike's experience, even in the army, I mean, he didn't have full conscious knowledge of this until after 44. But the memory, when it came back, when he was 44, came back in one big atomic blast, if you like, splintering him wide apart. And he said, I knew in an instant. He said, I came to talking about atoms. He said, I don't know anything about atoms. This is a gentleman who had zero education, just because that's just the way it went at that time in his, you know, in life for him. And so he wasn't schooled in that kind of thing or physics, but he kind of came to consciousness, waking consciousness, if you like, talking about that, and also realizing that the pharmaceutical world had a lot to answer for. It was like everything was just dropped into his mind about the state of the planet, what was going on, about the control, about the manipulation. He just kind of knew it in an instant, along with his experiences. And he had a memory of one particular one which stayed with him even after the others faded. And over the last 20 years, those other memories have hooked back in permanently, if you like.
Mm.
And the military one, which is the first one, I think is absolutely incredible because it shows military collusion unequivocally, in my opinion.
They do. That has been, one of the things I'd like to talk about before we finish is the sort of common strands that Amash brought out in your years with it. But one of the things that's really struck me is how often military people are involved and how often one of their parents has been in the military, and quite often both of them.
Yes. And indeed, his father was in the military, but as far as he's aware, had nothing to do with any experiences or is aware of anything. And is not a person that this is a natural subject to. And indeed, it wasn't for Mike either. It's only when he had that brain-splitting, paradigm-busting experience that he had to allow that that was what had happened. And on one occasion, I mean, he was abducted twice, at least, when he was in the military, as well as put through a mind-control program, which we think was probably done to him, perpetrated on him, by the British in Porton Down, but with the collusion of the Americans, because they were working together. So the poor thing had to undergo a huge amount of fairly traumatic interaction, which was then compartmentalized until such time as this download came, and then the memories bleeding through and then anchoring permanently as time went on, and hence the book.
Presumably, you didn't know anything about those technologies either, which are all now extremely well documented from the 40s and 50s.
Had not a clue.
No.
Not a clue. I mean, Mike talks about himself with some disparaging terms or tones before the wake-up of 44 as a really thick person. And I said, well, that's really unkind, and, I can't let you do that because you were not allowed to know the facts. You were kept, you were manipulated and traumatized to a point where there was no way you had access to those memories, except, it seems like E.T. wanted him to know. Or was this planned by the military like a time capsule that would suddenly bust open at 44 years old? Now, listen, he's not the only person who's had these sudden downloads or remembrances.
Again, really, really common in your shows. In fact, that's one of the problems, isn't it? Is that people, by and large, don't experience, well, they don't remember it, experiencing it when it actually happens. The vast majority of them seem to have a download or a revelation or whatever we want to call it. And that's one of the things that sort of, I guess, damages their credibility. We have
Yeah, absolutely.
We have no physical evidence, and they don't know what was happening to them. And everybody goes, well, that's obviously nonsense.
And but also the physical evidence can be, you know, very embarrassing. You know, you might get rashes down below. You might get, you know, some difficulties in the reproductive region because it's a very common area of work, let's say, of exploration. But also you may get scoop marks, bruises, the implants.
Which is another thing. The illnesses are pretty common too, and a kind of sudden arising of psychic and telepathic abilities and the like.
Oh, that is absolutely incredible. I mean, absolutely amazing. That has just amazed me throughout the research. It's like a keynote of the interaction.
And again, in a world where proof is extremely hard to come by, psychic experiences are quite often verifiable, even if they're not explicable. So it seems again to me to be a, if you like, if you're trying to prove your own veracity in something, then a bit like the patterned interfering with the dowsing we were talking about earlier, then giving people psychic experiences which can be validated if not explained is as good a way of bringing it across as any.
Yeah, well, I tell you, one of the real things that happened to Mike that we know that occurred, is which was a physical material element to it from an abduction, and on this one occasion he had to go. I think it was about 45 minutes to a location. He was working as a driver to pick up a massive bearing, and this was for a ship. So this was a quarter to a half a ton or third of a ton of phosphor bronze. I hadn't even heard of phosphor bronze. I had to look it up. Yeah. And he said at that time, years ago, and even maybe now, it's very valuable. He said it's more expensive than gold.
We used it in all the electrical gear we made in my first job. All the washers were made of phosphor bronze. I think it's quite important.
Really? Yes. Well, I'd never heard of it before. And anyway, so it was this massive blank, if you like, that was meant to be for a ship, and his job that day was to go pick up this piece, this half ton or quarter of a ton, whatever it was, of, I mean, you know, look, that's fairly heavy, right? Fairly heavy.
Yeah.
So there it was on his truck or van, whatever he carried in, and then he went back to his base, which was only, you know, so the whole trip should have taken him an hour and a half. Three quarters of an hour there, pick up the thing, three quarters of an hour back. Certainly no more, right? So when he got there at 4 o'clock, but he didn't know that. He thought he was there, you know, let's say he'd gone at 11, he thought it was like 12:30 or something.
Yeah.
So he honestly thought that the company were being very difficult, and because the boss was away at that time, that two of the company members had taken a guinea and were wanting to get rid of him whilst the boss was away, because this is the only logical thing he could make sense of. So finally, even though they showed him the clock, even though they put it in front of his nose, he could not accept it because it wasn't his experience as far as he was concerned. He just thought this was a plan to get rid of him. I mean, because he said, look, Joanne, when these things happen to you, you go for the most logical route of explanation. And he said, whilst they were nice people before, I just thought they decided somehow to get rid of me, and this was a way to do it. So anyway, so he was having none of that, right? And they could not, there was an impasse. So finally, the you know, standing boss said, well, let's just go and get the metal then. So off they went to the truck, and it was gone. Gone. Now, he has the memory now of what happened on that occasion, but he didn't have it then. He knows, he didn't see the phosphor bronze being nicked by E.T., the naughty things.
At that stage, he still wouldn't have believed a single word of it anyway.
No, he didn't, and indeed he did not.
And it didn't that doesn't make it any the less true, does it?
You know what? He was quite traumatized by that. He was really upset because he just thought that he was being done. But also, he had no explanation for the disappearance of that massive piece of metal.
Well, what explanation could you have?
Well, exactly. You know, and also, as far as he was, you know, he would have put his life on the line and said, I went straight there. I came straight back. I know the time it would have taken me to do it because he'd been to that place many times. Mm. It wasn't like it was a brand new location and he got lost or he stopped for lunch or tea or anything.
And like I say, that I think was that was the distinctive thing about his story in your chats with him, was the fact that there was all this weirdness that was witnessed by so many other people and it disturbed them, and it only got explained later. And although the explanation seems somewhat bizarre, you do, if you don't accept that one, you've still got to somehow explain the disappearance of the phosphor bronze bearing or any number of other things that went on.
That's right. Absolutely weird stuff. So, I mean, you know, I really, my heart goes out to these folks because, you know, whatever anybody else in the chat room or any other room or forum thinks, these people have been through real events as far as they're concerned, and it has real impact on their lives. And when you're living that life of these psychological dilemmas and schisms, and you feel broken and you don't know why you feel broken, or you feel challenged, or your health is in the toilet and you don't know what kicked that off, or you know, for goodness sake, those are as real as I can tell you. That impacts your life, and your family and friends leave you when they can't hack it anymore because they think you're nuts because you're talking about this stuff. That's real. And you know, what I can say to all of you guys who poo-poo all this, you go and live their life. You go and spend a day or two or a year or two in their shoes and then come back and tell me that you think I'm nuts or they're nuts.
And I think that talking to, again, this was something I was talking about earlier, I think that talking to the individuals themselves, I mean, listening to you talking to them is a good sort of stand-in. But in my opinion, the best way of dealing with people who've got really strange ideas is to find one and talk to them, because they're ultimately the same as you and me.
Of course they are.
And actually meeting people face to face and talking to them really helps, you know, because all we're getting is secondhand stories here.
Absolutely. That's why I've been doing what I've been doing, because the horse's mouth is always best.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I can help facilitate the horse.
Yeah.
And all of that with my, you know, absolute fascination, curiosity and, you know, almost obsession.
Yeah. Yeah. But now, at least it seems the guys who are doing the biolocation describe their processes as a sturdy scientific model. They're obviously very sure of their own results. And if we could understand what they're doing, then we might be more willing to take it on board. But The point is, as far as I'm concerned, that these guys appear to have a means at last of actually demonstrating a bit more assuredly what's going on, and they're obviously trying very hard at doing it. That's could be a real game changer, which is why I wanted to pay some attention to it.
Yes, and when I have more under my belt, I will be happy to share that. And also, what they are trying to do, and I've come up with a suggestion that I hope we go ahead with. They were trying to get the attention of the British Dowsing Society, who, you know, have a very different view of all of this kind of things, and they're not really that open to this field, if you like, and where it's going and what they're finding. And I honestly believe you can't start this brand new stuff with the old stuff. You've got to start afresh. Mm. You've got to start with the new intentions, the new ideas, not with closed-minded old associations. It just doesn't work.
No.
So I'm hoping that we're going to found together a scientific dowsing society or foundation or whatever in the not-too-distant future. How that all comes together, I'm not sure.
It does have to be said that the British Dowsing Association hasn't managed to bring the whole thing any closer to recognition, I don't think.
Well, no, I mean, this can, you know, it needs more people on board. It needs more people to come and try and explore and be willing to be open to this before they become the naysayers. Mm. When you've tried it for yourself and you don't think it's a goer, fair enough, but not beforehand.
I've had a couple of goes at dowsing which were quite definitively positive, results as far as I'm concerned. And I've seen people demonstrating dowsing with stones and rods and things like that. Yeah. And I've seen people getting reproducible effects doing that. So again, like you say, you can't really beat the experience. And so what about this Ellis character that you were mentioning before the break?
It's a guy called William Morris. William Morris, isn't it? Beg your pardon. William Mills Tompkins. And I just thought, because I know that we are off shortly, aren't we? You're finishing at 12.
Yes.
And this is a guy who's come forward. He's an elderly gentleman now. I'm not sure of his birth year. It might be late 20s. And in the 40s, he was working with some extraterrestrials and the naval intelligence people in the US. And I'd like to read just a little bit of the beginning of his book, which I just received, which tells you a little bit better and gives a little bit more background to his beginnings of where he came on. This guy, there's been one or two people who are clearly brilliant, but quietly, you know, kind of under the radar, brilliant. But meanwhile, their specialisms have been used in the military. And this guy is clearly one of those. Now, he's only just come forward in this last year. So he's done, and I'm hoping to get him onto my show when I do come back, and to interview him and to have him share, again, that horse's mouth thing. Because what he's saying is that the Nazis had two flying saucer programs. I'm going to call them that because that's what he called them. One civilian, which had actually begun in the 1890s, and then when the German Nazis came to power, this that was still ongoing. They went and investigated it, and then replicated what they'd done, and created a military arm of that. Of course, it's mooted often, but this guy.
I've heard about it a lot.
All right. Well, what this guy, just as a baseline, what this guy has also said, that as a youngster, because of his specific unbelievable skills, which I'll just mention in a second, he was privy to debriefing meetings of some of the 28 or so undercover spies that had German ancestry, that had infiltrated the Nazi war machine in their specialism in this field of propulsion and anti-gravity technology. And they were then feeding back, to which this guy would be part of the debriefing meetings. Now, his specialism is that he has that photographic memory like some do, but he also had a fantastic skill for not only remembering everything that he saw, but he could then, like a draftsman, draw things out, and then he could build it. So this guy, as a 9-year-old, was having gone on board some of the Navy aircraft with its latest stuff. No photographs or anything like that was allowed, but he'd walk the length of it. He'd remember all the details, and he'd go back home. And he, from his own sketches and stuff that he would make, would then create these stunning, stunning replicas.
Wow. What a thing to be able to do.
Stunning replicas with all the secret technology showing as well, which is what got him into the naval intelligence. So
he was doing something far more than just look at it.
Well, exactly. Mm. So I'm just going to pick it up from this paragraph. And this is from his book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, My Life in the Top Secret World of UFOs, Think Tanks and Nordic Secretaries. Nordic, read ET. And they're women. They're women, which is very interesting because the women are coming out with the technology. But anyway, this is before he got into all of that. And it says, on February the 25th, 1942, 3 months after the attacks on Pearl Harbor, a very strange thing happened. By the time my family had moved to Long Beach, we were now living in a high second floor apartment that was converted from a large house. It was only 4 blocks from the ocean, and about 8 o'clock on the night in question, my father called my brother and me onto our deck, which faced the bay. There was a strange, intense light just above the horizon, a narrow beam pointing towards the ocean. The little beam turned horizontally right into our eyes and hit the back wall of our apartment and the surrounding trees. It was blinding. Suddenly and bafflingly, the light went out. Whatever it was had gone. There was nothing else we could do but stand there amazed and finally retire to bed. Now, just after midnight, an air raid siren went, and anti-aircraft guns of the coastal artillery woke everyone up. We ran out onto the street and saw a large round craft about 7,000 feet up floating in the air above us. It slowed to a stop overhead and remained stationary. It was lit up by 8 searchlights while anti-aircraft shells burst all around and against it. Most of the shells exploded on the bottom of the craft. We just couldn't believe the thing hadn't exploded or been shot down. 3, then 5 other ships appeared near it. Some of the searchlights, as well as the anti-craft teams, focused on each one as they passed the first object. Eventually, the first craft slowly departed as well. Later on, about 12 other craft passed by at higher altitudes and were in turn fired upon. It was like a spell. Why weren't the hundreds of us who were watching this event concerned or even frightened? I wasn't scared. There was no panic. No one was screaming. There were no heart attacks. And no one was going crazy. Other vehicles continued to pass over us for nearly 5 hours. Our coastal artillery and anti-aircraft crews attempted to shoot down these strange flying machines. By 3:30 a.m., the main show was over. Unconcerned, we went back to bed, although several neighbours told us that the air raid continued and the alarm lasted until 5 a.m. The next morning, the newspapers reported the foreign craft had been spotted in the airspace between Santa Monica and Long Beach. They failed to mention that half of Southern California watched the event nearly all night. This so-called Los Angeles air raid became the first major incident in a long string of events connected to the UFO phenomenon in recent history, and it was the start of many encounters affecting my entire 57 years of aerospace engineering. For whatever reason, the public may not have accepted the reality of what we had witnessed or in another world that had interacted with our lives. I realized that there had to be a massive interplanetary mothership or motherships orbiting our planet and from somewhere out in the galaxy. The mothership had dispatched hundreds of landing-type platform vehicles to Earth. The nature of their mission was totally unknown. World War II was raging. We had our hands full with the Nazis. And now this? Furthermore, there were several people in the Navy Department, Army Air Corps, and an aircraft company whose entire lives were now impacted. They were Admiral Roscoe H. Hillencutter, Secretary of the Navy, James V. Forrestal, Army Air Corps General Nathan F. Twining, and General Curtis LeMay. Now,
There's a man with a hell of an imagination who managed to cause an outbreak of mass hysteria, clearly.
Well, you know, people have heard of the Battle of Los Angeles, but this is somebody who was watching it. This is amazing. This was somebody who was watching it. And Bill, he goes by the name of Bill, was on the Jeff Renz show, for anybody who knows Jeff Renz show. And Jeff Renz himself had done a tremendous amount of research on this Battle of Los Angeles event in 1942, bearing in mind 3 months prior, the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor and that they were in the middle of World War II. And he'd actually spoken to an air raid warden that night. So it's amazing. You know, so it's validated, you know, absolutely. But what I wanted to mention was that James V. Forrestal was the guy who was incarcerated in Bethesda Hospital, and I don't have the time frame. I'm sorry, I can't remember the whole story of the time frame. But not only was he way up there as the head lead of all of this material to do with the UFOs and research, but he was then in years later. Whatever happened to him, we don't know, or whether he was going to go public and nobody wanted him to, we don't know. But he was taken to Bethesda, I think it was Naval Hospital, where he, oh dear, he died. He actually jumped from a window. Well, why?
It seems to be quite a common thing for people who are studying ETs to do, doesn't it?
That's right. And General Nathan F. Twining was the guy who kept a lid on the Roswell stuff and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I interviewed an elderly lady who told me that she had about 5 or 7 years now previously gone out to America and met his son. because his father was long dead.
That was that was a great interview too. That was a great story too.
And he had told his son on his deathbed that Roswell was real and that he had met one of these beings, an alien grey type, and he had had association stroke friendship with this being for 15 years, which meant it would have died in about 1963. And the other person I want to mention, who was mentioned here, is General Curtis LeMay. General Curtis LeMay was the guy who took David Adair under his wing. And David Adair is the guy who was another savant boy genius who was making rockets. And when I say making rockets, I mean like nothing we've ever seen. He was doing this kind of propulsion that is not the normal rocketry. And he was told by Wernher von Braun, watch out for, I think his name is Arthur Rubin, somebody like that. And anyway, Arthur Rubin got hold of him and took him to Area 51. And when they went down several levels, they took him to a craft. Well, actually, they didn't take him to a craft. They took him to an engine, which had belonged to a craft. And what he saw, what David Adair saw, was the engine, a replica. He said his engine was about the size of a watermelon, and that could shift some weight. But this was the size of a bus, and but his had all these wires. This had no wires, but he recognized it for what it was, but it was damaged. And when he asked if he could step up, because it was big enough for him to step onto, he was only about 17 at this time, there was a symbiotic relationship going on, which he hadn't quite twigged until a few moments later, when he suddenly realized that not only was this not from our world, but there would have been occupants and there would have been a craft attached to it. And when he came out, he was steaming mad and said, where the hell are these occupants? Who does this belong to? And why the hell are you keeping this secret from the American people? And he was livid. As this 17-year-old, he was livid. And so there was a bit of a kerfuffle going on as the military went to kind of grapple with him as he was getting down from the craft engine. And he noticed that on his way down, because he was so angry, the metal, the alloys changed to reflect him. Reflect his emotions. And he then understood that this was a symbiotic piece of technology. So Curtis LeMay, all these guys I've just read out, and there are many more, are all deeply, deeply embedded and involved in the in 1942.
And they're what would be counted as reliable witnesses.
I would say so.
You know, if this was all kind of imagination and makey-uppy and stuff like that, then they'd have found it hard, I would have thought, to hold on to their positions and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, Bill Tompkins, this is just the first volume. He thinks there's probably going to be 3 or 4 volumes because there is so much to say. And he did say that he had actually approached the Admiralty with his manuscript and said, you know, I really feel it's time to speak about this. What's your opinion? And he said, go away and tell it all. So now I don't know I don't know what that means. Okay, so we've got this material out there. Do we believe him? Well, you know, that's up to the individual. But, you know, the guy's, I don't know what age he is exactly, 80-odd. And you know, this is a phenomenal person because whatever you think about the story, there's so much unbelievable detail. And the fact that he talks about the Nazis and he talks about how, I don't know whether people remember, but there was a story that Admiral Byrd, for those who may not remember, was the guy who saw a lot of craft, about 7 of them, I think, coming over Mount Rainier, 47, I think it was. And he reported that, and that's where the term, they say, flying saucer came from. It didn't, but anyway, it'll do for now.
Yeah.
But he apparently went off with a fleet to Antarctica. I can't remember it was 48, whenever it was. And now this wasn't just like a fishing trip. He went with over 4,000 guys. He went with aircraft carrying ships. And what he reported, this guy is also referencing, Bill Tompkins. He is saying, because Admiral Byrd came back, they were supposed to be going out there for about 4 months. They came back within a couple of weeks having been absolutely hammered. there were ships that were sunk, and they were reporting that ships had come out of the sea and taken out every single craft that we had flying over. So what Tompkins is saying, and this will blow blow your socks off, is that the Nazis had made an agreement with the reptilians. Americans had made an agreement with the Nordics. And the reptilians had suggested, because by 1942, it was the Germans knew that they would not be winning the war. So to continue with their research, which was super secret, and we know this because of what the spies came back and reported to the group or working party that Tompkins was privy to, was that the reptilians had suggested that they move all their operations of secret technology development, etc., down to there were three massive caverns in Antarctica where they could continue their work. And apparently that is what they did. And the spies were reporting back. And then wouldn't it be great to get the name of these spies?
Yeah, wouldn't it?
Maybe we'll get Tompkins on and ask him if he knows their names.
Yeah.
Reporting that suddenly the technology that they'd been seeing being worked on and hence reporting back about was suddenly disappeared. It had suddenly gone, and they didn't know where, but did find out then later that they believed it had been taken off to Antarctica, because we know that the Germans were building these massive, massive submarines, these massive carriers for taking all this stuff, you know. Over the
year or so that you were on, you've mentioned many books actually that are of a similar ilk and a similar authority. And really, if we're being asked to imagine that none of this is really going on, then every single one of those books has to be a work of fiction.
Yes, very clever. I mean, you know, the human mind is incredibly inventive, and everything's a possibility. But, you know, there comes a time when you can cross-reference things, you know, like this elderly lady coming to me at 85 years old saying, I don't want to go to my deathbed with this, to my death with this secret. And I was as astonished as anybody could be, because I couldn't believe that an English person could have a secret about Roswell. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that was a real scoop, but...
isn't it amazing how it's individuals? It's just kind of one individual here and one individual there, but it shows how important we all are and how important it is that we do what we feel we need to do.
Well, it is also, because had there been no such body as Amash, and there will be the ET newsroom in its place in due course, but, you know, nobody would have had anybody to report that to.
No. No, and what's more, anybody they did report it to would have been busily trying to make them feel kind of ridiculed and sidelined and marginalised.
Absolutely.
So you're planning on coming back to us then, Joanne? You're not running off to join the circus or something?
No circuses would have me, I don't think. yes, eventually. I just need to get, you know, other things sorted out so I can run my life a bit more smoothly. But I have got some amazing people that I want to speak to in the wings that I'm lining up. And, you know, I am working behind the scenes, not consistently, but to some degree. So there's work being generated for when I do get back.
Well, that's great, because I, as you know, I for one really look forward to you coming back. I regard your shows as a real education, and frankly, if you're bonkers, then I'm as bonkers as you are, mate.
Join the train.
I don't think that comes as any surprise to anybody, frankly. But thank you so much for coming on tonight, and I look forward to keeping up with you. I'm sure we'll find a good reason to talk again.
And, yes, thanks very much, and we'll also talk about the show idea a little bit further down the line as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, didn't quite make it that far this time round, but that just leaves us with a bit of yeast for the next show. And you're always welcome to come on here and outrage the chat box whilst you haven't got a show of your own.
Wonderful.
It's a lot more pleasant in the navigator's seat, isn't it? Anyway, thanks a lot. I'm going to play one more tune. That was you've been listening to Joanne Summerscales, of course, of once of the Amash Files and soon to be of the ET Newsroom, which I'm really looking forward to. So big thanks to Joanne. Coming up in a very few minutes' time, Freeman Jack, back on Thursday nights at the Witching Hour. Whoopee! The world is set to rights. And here's the Steve Gibbons Band and Riding on a BSA.
Night all.
Night, folks.